de la revolución del mundo.
Justice by any means necessary.
This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2024 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us at Socialism 2025, which will be held in Chicago next summer, July 3rd through the 6th, 2025. If you are ready to put ideas into action and get organized with others from across the country and the world, make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
So I'll let y'all take it away, and please introduce yourselves.
Okay, hello. So Anin Bujo, Wabnan Anangonkwe Indigenous. If you know me on Facebook, everybody else calls me Patty. That's where I pay my taxes, is as Patty. I wrote a book a couple years ago, Becoming Kin. We're coming up on our two-year birthday, which is kind of cool. And it started off because I was really mad about, you know how like everybody, Canadians, Americans, Christians, everybody is all like, that's not who we are every time something bad happens. Well, Becoming Kin is kind of like five chapters of, yes, that is. But then we can do something about it, because at the end of the day, we all got to live on this planet. My next book is going to be out next year, and it's called Bad Indians Book Club. Looking at if we read subaltern writers, listen to subaltern thinkers, how does that help us to imagine the world that Becoming Kin wants you to imagine? So I'm from Niagara Falls, and largely urban native community. My reserve is Lac Seul First Nation, which is about 2,000 kilometers away from home. Still in Ontario. Ontario is pretty huge. You drive 3 days, still be in Ontario. So that's where my family's from. Ojibwe, Anishinaabe through my dad, German, Ukrainian through my mom. So I feel like I carry both the obligation of hospitality and generosity. Thinking about Daniel Heath Justice, who said, confronting those memes that we all love about, you know, how Native people should have had better homeland security, and we think that's really funny. But he says, the generosity of our ancestors was never the problem, and we should not be challenging who they were with their generosity and willingness to share and caretake. The problem is the exploitation that came afterwards. And the way that gift was received, that's the problem, not our ancestors. So I carry with me the generosity of my ancestors and the responsibility to care for this land that knows them and the waters that know them. But I also carry the responsibility of my mother's family, which is to think about how I enter the land, to quote Natalie Diaz, how I enter the land and how I build relationships and then how I welcome others. So that's me. I'm officially retired, legally retired. I spent 16 years actually working in child welfare. Boo! That's what radicalized me, right? I always say that my time in child welfare made me an abolitionist, because I entered as a true believer, thinking that I could keep kids safe, and I realized over time that I was actually causing more harm, and I was not making children safe. And so anyway, so I left that work. And now I'm kind of a free agent. Like, who are you? What are you going to do? Who are you going to complain to? Yeah, I got no more HR department. What, are you going to not buy my book? Ooh. So that's me. And I kind of help organize with not just the Native community, but kind of a larger, is a broad coalition. Of course, right now our focus is on Palestine. And the community in Niagara, the community organizing in Niagara, are holding rallies every Sunday afternoon. Every Sunday afternoon. They're either down at the foot of the falls or they're at a location in St. Catharines. Every Sunday afternoon. And I get out as much as I can. Sometimes they're very small rallies. Sometimes they're very big rallies. But every Sunday afternoon they're there. And tomorrow they're going to be building and flying white kites for the poet. And I just thought that was so beautiful, and I'm kind of sad. I love being here in Chicago, but I'm kind of sad that I won't be there for that. But anyway, that's what they're doing. We have the Kashmiri flag here today. A friend of mine is actually here. There's a table for Kashmir in that way. And they have letters that you can send to your politicians because the Kashmir people are being silenced, just as the people in Khasa are being silenced. And the Kashmir community in Toronto is very active in organizing solidarity rallies and doing a lot of that heavy labor so that the Palestinians can focus on other things. So they're doing a lot of work there, and so that's, I want to recognize the solidarity between all of these anti-colonial struggles. And I appreciate that you guys skipped the Warrior Woman Project to come and be here. So I do have some cards from them, or you can stop by their table as well, because you can live stream the film on their website.
Bujwani Fon Pochelle Indijnaka, Chicago Dunjamba. I'm Fon E. Pochelle. I was born and raised here in Chicago. I identify as Soto. My father is a status member of Key First Nations in Saskatchewan. He is a 60 Scoop survivor. He was born and taken away from his family in Swan River, Manitoba, and then adopted out to a Midwest farming family right outside of Champaign-Urbana in Normal, Illinois as a teenager. And also as a teenager, he came to Chicago on his way to find Native community, looking for his home, ended up, you know, setting up shop here, hooking up with my mom, having four kids. And so on my mother's side, I am predominantly Irish. We come from a history of forced removal as well. My mother's grandmothers and great aunts were all emigrated here from County Cork to help set up Irish Catholic families here in the city of Chicago, as Chicago was becoming more and more accepting of Irish people through the process of colonization and through the process of becoming white. So like Patty, I also feel like I have an obligation as an Anishinaabe Kwe to welcome people to my lands. Even though I'm First Nations, Chicago is my ancestral territory. I was born and raised here. These waterways, these lands, all of our plant and animal relatives have sustained my family since time immemorial. And my family continues to uphold that tradition in the way that we rear our children and the way that we try to work with building communities of solidarity, and also confronting the ways that our Native community here in Chicago do not hold those same values, because we are all living as colonized bodies working to survive, right? I would like to acknowledge that in my day job, I am an agent of the state. I work for Northeastern Illinois University in our cultural center. I am lucky that during this time in higher education, my institution is a working class, majority minority serving institution, so we don't have to face some of the issues that U of Chicago is facing, right? I wouldn't work there if we did. And so our connections to some of the colonizing bodies is also, like, we are a state-run agency. We depend on federal funds. We depend on state funds. And, you know, we were built, not meant for the student body that we serve. And so in that work, I have to confront, like, what is it that I'm doing here on a daily basis? I am lucky that, like, I have a colleague, colleagues and a direct supervisor who share some of the same social justice views and morals that I share, which makes life easier. Before coming into that workspace, I was working for the American Indian of Chicago, or American Indian Center of Chicago. I left in early 2021 after they put up a All Lives Matter mural in November of 2020 on Election Day. And the consensus for me was I had to leave. It took me a while to figure out how I could make good on the promises I made, but eventually I just had to say, like, I can no longer cause harm in this space. And so the work that I do now is the work that I thought I was always doing, is trying to confront harm and help my Native community and the communities I've grown up in Chicago do more healing than harm, be more creative than consumers. So now I know that, like, because of the harm I created for the years that I spent working for this nonprofit organization, it's going to take me a lifetime to, like, confront all of that misdoings that I've done. But that's me.
Yeah, I feel that very deeply, because the week that broke me, in my last week of working in child welfare, a mom had said to me that I had ruined her life. And I couldn't even disagree with her, because I had argued with my supervisor at every decision point, saying, we are not helping this family. This is not helping. This is making things worse. This is not helping. And so when she said to me, you ruined my life, and all I could think in my brain went that I was just following orders, right? And my brain just kind of went crack. because that didn't fly in Nuremberg, and that doesn't fly anywhere. And I can't undo those harms. So I actually run a foundation. It's called the Nicanagana Foundation, payyourrent.ca, because I was, you know how tiresome some white people can be on Twitter when they feel really, really bad about being colonizers, and they just want absolution or something, and they just kind of, I also think that it might be a kink to want to be spanked by Native people and told how terrible they are. I don't know, I'm not here to kink shame, but there's something a little weird about that. I mean, I'm okay. If they want to hire me, I'll take their money to come and talk to them for 45 minutes about how terrible they are. So I said, you know, if you feel that bad, why don't you pay some rent? And then I thought, actually, that's a great idea. So I created this thing on Patreon, and now we're a registered nonprofit. We actually made the decision not to be a charity, because charities are really limited in what they can do. They can't do anything that seems partisan. And unless you're trying to assimilate Native people into the state, you're being partisan and you'll lose your charitable status. So we're a nonprofit. You won't get a tax receipt. Plus, you're American and we're Canadian, so you wouldn't get a tax receipt anyway. But we do. We take that money and then we spend it. Literally paying people's rent sometimes, but also funding organizers who are building their communities, because you got to do both things, right? For mutual aid, you got to meet people's material needs, but you also have to fight against the reasons for those material needs. Otherwise, all you're doing is sustaining the project. So we do both of those things. It's really cool, but that's something that I did in part because I know I can't fix the harms, and so that's part of the work that I do to address the overarching system that I was part of that caused harm. And so I really feel that deeply. And you think about that all the time. And I've been out of it for 5 years now. And yeah, and it still sits on me, especially that woman's words. So Rabbi Brant Rosen said something really neat last night. He was talking about not being an ally in the Palestinian struggle, but coalition building, being part of a coalition and being accountable to the Palestinians. And I would broaden that out in our context today to think that, you know, we're not looking for allies. We're not even necessarily looking for accomplices. I really like that idea of building coalitions that are accountable to those whose liberation is at stake. So if we're building, if we're part of a coalition around Black Lives Matter, then we're not painting murals that say all lives matter. We are prioritizing the needs of the people whose liberation is at stake. Besides, if cops stop killing Black people, they'll stop killing us too. Right? Right? Like, if we can organize the system differently, if we get land back, then everybody gets a better life because there's no landlords. Right? So, and everybody gets a better life. What I am primarily is a storyteller. So I'm going to tell you what is probably my favorite story. And if you go hear Leanne Simpson later this afternoon, you'll probably hear it because she uses it a lot in her work. And it's the story of the deer abandoning the Anishinaabeg. So a long time ago, we were not behaving very well, right? Creation narrative in the Anishinaabe tradition follows kind of a similar trajectory to the one we're all familiar with. It makes sense from an evolutionary standpoint, that you get planets, and then you get water, and then you get land, and then you get plants and animals, and then you get people. Except that instead of us being the pinnacle of creation, which was what I learned when I was growing up in my evangelical, the rapture's happening any minute now family, for the Anishinaabeg, we are the least and most needy of all creation. Because look at everything we need in order to survive. Right? We need plants and animals and water and land and air and sky and a planet to put our feet on. Like, we need so much. And this earth had lived fine without us. Now, that's not the same anymore, because the land has shaped us and we have shaped the land. We are now part of the environment. So it's not like, you know, it's not like the eco-fascists would say that we could just kind of remove humans from the earth and everything would be fine. The earth needs us now too. And it's a reciprocal relationship. But we see ourselves as the least and most needy. And the Anishinaabe a long time ago forgot about that and started thinking that they were the lords of the earth. And the deer, although they had made that promise to take care of us, because every layer of creation promised to take care of the layers that came next, if you don't exist anymore, you're not around to keep your promises anyway. So the deer peaced out. And they're like, you know what? We're out of here. We're not going to hang around to be exterminated. And I don't know what happened with the other animals, because as we all know, when you lose one resource, you immediately start turning towards the others and start leaning more heavily on them. So I don't know if, you know, the beaver and the moose and the others saw what was going on and maybe thought that that was a good idea for them to peace out too. Or I don't, the story doesn't tell us that, because it's about the deer and the Anishinaabe, but I could imagine that the other animals would be a little bit stressed about the deer peacing out and possibly a little bit resentful about being left behind. And I'm sure the Anishinaabe felt sorry for themselves at first, because of course they would. But after all that long, hungry winter of listening to their stories and things that they thought might have been funny, I suspect they started to hear them a little bit differently and started to realize that maybe they were the bad guy in this story. Maybe the story about Nana Bush grabbing the ducks and wringing their necks, maybe that's not a funny story. Maybe that's a warning. Anyway, so they sent out runners in the spring, and a little deer came out to meet one of the runners. And I have to believe that the deer had been watching to know that the Anishinaabe had kind of come to their senses. And we don't know what the deer were doing, having their deer ceremonies, singing their deer songs, living a life knowing that they weren't being hunted. I don't know what happened. In one version of this story, the Anishinaabe thought that the ravens had captured the deer and were holding them captive, only to find out that the ravens were actually protecting the deer who had peaced out. But anyway, the long story short is when the deer agreed to meet with the Anishinaabe had to listen. And this wasn't like a truth and reconciliation commission where you've only got 20 minutes to speak your truth. This wasn't like the missing and murdered Indigenous women inquiry that we had in Canada, where the government says you're not allowed to investigate the police. The Anishinaabe just had to listen until the deer were done talking. And then, because at that point they were at a place of equality and humility, they were able to put their relationship back together. And for me, when I think about resurgence as Indigenous peoples, when I think about forming coalitions of accountability to the people whose liberation is at stake, I think about the importance of us being able to kind of go off on our own. And to, because we're not going to be able to confront the tropes, we're not going to be able to, like, I mean, how many of us will go along to get along because it's safer that way? Instead of standing up against the state and get water cannons aimed at us, you know, as we saw happen in Standing Rock, or get criminalized as what happens in Wet'suwet'en and in Halifax, a Stop Alton Gas action, which my son was involved with because he lives out in Halifax. You know, instead they become part of the state. And one of the things that Tara, who has COVID and is not able to, that's why she's not able to be with us today, that she had pointed out was that this current administration has opened up more drilling than opened up under Trump. And that's under the Ministry of the Interior. Who runs the Ministry of the Interior? Right. So you put a Native woman in charge of the Ministry of Interior and everybody's like, yay! Except that they've opened up more space for drilling under her watch. That's the peaceful Indian. that's, you know, we're going to take these crumbs that you offer us in the hopes that we stay alive a little bit longer. And I don't want to completely dismiss that, because if we can stay alive a little bit longer, then we can live to fight another day. But I also, I don't like seeing it proposed as a solution. It's not the solution. It's like I think about those tiny house communities that are getting built all over the place and they're being proposed as a solution. And then I was at the care washing. Was anybody at the care washing thing yesterday afternoon? Yeah, I was listening to what they were talking about, the care washing as a way of the state kind of co-opting grassroots movements and then shifting it to extend the authority and the carcerality of the state. And I was thinking about those tiny house communities that so many towns are building, which we know from Grapes of Wrath as Hoover towns, that's what they're doing. When it was a grassroots movement, there was a guy in Toronto who was building tiny homes, and it was a grassroots movement, that was one thing. But then one of those houses caught fire, and suddenly they're all unsafe, unlike apartment buildings where one of them catches fire, but they're still safe, which is really weird. Like, if my house catches fire, then everybody's still allowed to live in three-bedroom bungalows. So that's really weird. But he got shut down because they didn't meet fire code or whatever, even though he had a smoke detector inside each one of them. And so now the city of Toronto is actually working with him to build them, but they're under a different person's authority. We were just talking about that with Friendship Centers as well, and urban Indian centers. That we go through this cycle of, you know, like, you've got the leadership and then the grassroots kind of rises up because the leadership is being, you know, kind of moving money around and doing, you know, playing colonial games and winning colonial prizes. And so the grassroots rises up against them and there's a new king in town. And then the same thing happens again. And 10 years later, the grassroots rises up and does it again and again and again. Because who's funding us? The federal government, the state, the province. And so, of course, that's who we're accountable to. We should be accountable to each other. And to me, that's also the message of the Deer abandoning the Anishinaabe, is taking that time to be accountable to each other so that after we have built our relationships together, then we can come together in these coalitions where, when I'm organizing for Palestine, I am accountable to the Palestinian people in that, because they are the people whose liberation is at stake in this thing. When we are organizing around land back, then they're accountable to us because it's our land and it's our liberation that's at stake. And these coalitions, I think, can work. I just love that so much. I wrote it down. I'm going to use it all the time because it's just so good. And then also Linda Sarsour last night, was she not amazing? I felt really bad for not standing during the standing ovation, but I was sitting on the floor, and I'm like going to be 59 in a few weeks. But I was standing in my heart. But like, what are you afraid of? Was the question she asked. What are you afraid of? Are you afraid of your oppressor defining who you are? Like, speak up. Define them yourself. No more peaceful Indian. Peaceful people, what's that thing? You know, no great big revolution ever happened because of peaceful people. We need to set that aside. And we need to speak boldly and plainly and think, what are we afraid of? What did Marx say? Obligatory socialist Marx reference. You have nothing to lose but your chains.
So yesterday was Chairman Fred Hampton's birthday. And so I was thinking about this panel and what was I going to say today, because I am never prepared. And so one of the quotes that I always think about in the work that I do is, theory without practice ain't shit, right? And so I have to acknowledge how much inspiration that the movement work I do is adopted from Black communities, right? Especially living here in the city of Chicago, where we think of either Native people being pre-1800s or through the relocation program in the 1950s, because those are the only narratives we get to talk about. And so when I think about the ways that, you know, the work I've been able to do over the past 12 plus years has really centered the way in which I have been culturalized as a Chicagoan, which is deeply tied to Black culture here in the city of Chicago. And I don't think that Native movement makers within this city often talk about that. And so I always wonder, you know, am I co-opting something or am I moving in solidarity? Because for so long, I thought my community growing up was any Native person who entered into the city space, right? They automatically become my community. And I wish I still thought like that, you know? I try to be a good host, right? That's just the blueprint of me being an Anishinaabe Kwe. But I also have to wonder, like, what is it that draws you to the city and what is it that you're going to do here, right? Because this city is no longer just an indigenous landscape for Native people who've been here for time immemorial. It's an indigenous landscape to our Black community who, as Patty was saying earlier, you know, grew these relationships with this land, right? And learned how to survive and reactualize themselves in a community after being ripped away and continuously being told their identity is no longer indigenous. And so I think about the writings of Kyle T. Mays, who's an Afro-Indigenous scholar, and the way that he explicitly states that, you know, Black identity comes from Indigenous identity, and where is it that that Indigenous identity was removed? And so if we can sit here in the city of Chicago and uphold, you know, folks who are 1/64th Ojibwe, and say these are our Native artists that we're going to look up to, why aren't we also being like, how are we adopting Black folks into Indigenous culture and Indigenous ways of knowing here in Chicago? And how are we also adopting other brown Indigenous folks into the way that we're building Indigenous coalitions here? And so, you know, this is a thing I think about all the time, and like I go down rabbit holes of like, how is it that I'm building solidarity? How is it that I'm welcoming? But also, how is it that I'm protecting myself? Because we're all colonized and we're all going to perpetuate harm in some way. And so me and my family, the Shai Nations Youth Council, we squatted land in the city of Chicago, which transformed into the First Nations Garden. And so at the top of that desire of what we want to see this space be, aside from being a permanent fixture in the city forever, you know, we wanted it to be a healing space. And in order for it to be a healing space, we couldn't claim it to be a safe space for anyone, right? Because we are going to be triggering other people with, you know, the dark sense of humor. We've had to adopt it as survival mechanisms. We are going to be triggering people with our stories of our harm in order to like narrate what it is that developed our own identities in this colonized space. And how are we taking those stories to help us unsettle the ways which we navigate not only the cityscape, but the way we build community? And so it's a lot, right? And as, you know, a white woman to some extent, I have to question, like, is what I'm doing a move towards innocence to be all like, I'm not perpetuating in the harm of these other folks when I most certainly have and probably will continue in ways that I'm not even going to recognize for years to come? Or is it a real desire to change what we face on a daily basis as colonized bodies, right? And so we all come with these own thought patterns and systems of ways how we're going to move forward, you know, whether we're anarchist or socialist, communist, right? What is it about those types of thought processes and political analysis? Are we able to work with each other and find commonality, right? I can work with someone no matter their political identity as long as they're saying they're not apolitical, right? Apolitical people are the most dangerous people because they have nothing to lose and they don't want to get outside of their comfort zone. Will I have dinner with everyone? Hell no. Like, I need to learn how to create boundaries. But that's one of the boundaries I have. So when I think about the ways that we have to like build communities and networks of solidarity, I think about the ways that we have to be honest, like, I'm going to harm you. That's just what relationships are. At some point, we're going to harm each other. It's an unfortunate circumstance of humanity, especially in our current state. But how is it that we can rectify that harm, right? If I'm causing harm, I shouldn't be the one talking. And thank you, Patty, for sharing the story about the deer. Because I'm Beaver Clan, right? And so there's all of these narcissistic tendencies that beavers have, like creating their own environment, you know, being little gossipers. But at the end of the day, what they do is they create ecosystems which benefit everyone, right? And so it isn't that, you know, beavers are only doing this for beavers. You know, they're actually creating ecosystems for other folks to aspire, to grow, to build. And so as someone who is Beaver Clan, I hope that's what my life work will be one day, right? If nothing else, you know, we have the First Nation Garden for 99 years in a community land trust. Is it managed by Native people? Yes. Is it owned by Native people? No. Is it rematriation of land or land back or however people are defining that movement in this day? No, right? It's owned by a utility of the city, neighbor space, right? But we're still the ones envisioning this space and working to replicate it. And the way that we do that is by building communities of solidarity. We host Native Sundays for Native people, for Indigenous people, for Black people, right? We don't want people coming in on Sundays and asking us to explain the whole history of the garden and to do work, free labor for them. But on the other side of that, a lot of us do that free labor. We host work days. We host community events in order to talk about the harms that were committed towards our land, committed towards our bodies. But there needs to be a balance. If all people want from Native people is to take and take and take from us, then that's your move to innocence, and that has nothing to do with us. And so reflecting on like this whole conference and looking at all of the wonderful Native speakers who are here, way more than last year, which is great, I also have to wonder, like, why are the majority of us folks who have higher education, like we're degreed Indians, whose voices are folks really willing to listen to when we look at the Natives who are in the spaces, right? Are we listening to regular Native people who are dealing with survival tactics? Because at the end of the day, that's who should be leading movements, right? Not the ones of us who have gone through processes of assimilation. And while we may have the words to talk about it in mixed company, a lot of the times we've been given opportunities that other folks haven't, right? And so when I think about Deb Holland, right, and the way that fracking and environmental degradation is happening at an alarming rate under her watch, I wonder at what point did that, you know, giving in happen, you know? And how often have I done that? I know I've done that because I worked at the American Indian Center for long, knowing I caused harm. I know that I continue to do that because I work for a state university, right? And our education system is definitely never meant to, like, perpetuate Native identity. It's never been meant for Black and brown folks, you know? It is a system of white supremacy that I walk into every day. And so the only way I can justify that is, you know, I'm working with brown and Black folks and Indigenous folks to survive a system that we have not figured out how to overcome because we don't have those networks of solidarity in place currently. And Patty said she's a storyteller. I don't know if I'm necessarily a storyteller, but I believe in narrative-led activism. If we're unable to talk with one another, then we're unable to move forward. I do a lot of my reflection of self through historical analysis. And so a lot of the work that I see the young folks in Shai Nations doing, that I see my family doing, isn't new, right? Fighting for land, fighting for access to outdoor spaces, you know, was done in the 1970s by the Chicago Indian Village. And they were seen as outsiders in the Native community here in Chicago by the American Indian Center. And that's exactly what's happening to us. Hopefully we last a little longer than the Chicago Indian Village. But the leaders of that movement worked with the Rainbow Coalition. They worked with the Young Lords. They worked with the Black Panthers. And because of that, they were able to take over Belmont Harbor. They had to be removed by the federal government. They got the president's attention at the time. And they were short-lived militant Indians who were often referred to as drunks. And so in the past few years, I've realized I'd rather work with militant drunks than peaceful Indians any day.
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.